You're listening to a recording provided for the use of the blind and print impaired. Materials or items read on Airs LA are the copyright property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Hello, I'm Michael Pieldrosch. Welcome to another recording of articles from Popular Science magazine, a presentation of Airs LA. This week's articles include, at 58 seconds, an original E.T. from 1982 movie could fetch $1 million at auction. At 4 minutes 55 seconds, cougar cubs spotted in Michigan for first time in over a century. And finally at 8 minutes 57 seconds, a startup wants to mine the moon for helium. Let's get to it. This first article is from the science section and is entitled, An Original E.T. from 1982 Movie Could Fetch $1 Million at Auction, written by Andrew Paul, published March 19, 2025. Warning, Reese's Pieces not included. This article begins with a photo of an E.T. model from E.T. the Extraterrestrial movie. Its caption reads, The model is one of only three made for the movie in 1982. A collection of sci-fi movie memorabilia is heading to auction and includes one of the most iconic film aliens of all time. As part of the upcoming series, There Are Such Things, 20th Century Horror, Science Fiction, and Fantasy on Screen, Sotheby's is offering an original, screen-used E.T. full-body model seen in Steven Spielberg's E.T. the Extraterrestrial. Designed by the late great special effects and makeup artist Carlo Rambaldi, the roughly 3-foot-tall piece of pop culture history was used in the famous closet scene and is one of just three manufactured during the making of the 1982 movie. While instantly recognizable today, E.T.'s overall look was completely absent from Melissa Matheson's screenplay. Creating the character from scratch came through a collaboration between Spielberg, storyboard artist Ed Vero, and Rambaldi. For the director, however, three particular historical figures came to mind for the diminutive alien. Quote, I remember saying to Carlo, here are some pictures of Albert Einstein, Ernest Hemingway, and Carl Sandburg. I love their eyes, unquote, Spielberg said in a 1996 behind-the-scenes documentary. Quote, can we make E.T.'s eyes as frivolous and also wizened and as sad as those three icons? Unquote. As for his other facial features, Rambaldi drew inspiration from his own life, his family's Himalayan cat, Kika. For the body, the artist wanted to reference the long necks of the women depicted in a 1952 painting titled Woman of the Delta from his home country of Italy. Multiple heads and torsos were required for the movie, each created for specific animatronic abilities. The end result was a physical prop capable of 150 different movements, including extending his neck even longer, furrowing his brow, and wrinkling his nose. The total cost to make E.T.? Over $1 million, about $3.3 million in 2025 money. There is an additional photo of an artist's hand with a pencil tracing E.T.'s face over the image of a Himalayan cat. Its caption reads, Rambaldi based some of E.T.'s facial features on his Himalayan cat, Kika. Carlo Rambaldi passed away in 2012 after a lifetime spent in the movie business. In addition to the E.T. model scheduled for auction, There Are Such Things also features other projects Rambaldi helped realize, including a 40-foot-tall animatronic King Kong for the 1976 remake starring Jeff Bridges and Jessica Lange, the Xenomorph from Alien, as well as a 20-foot-long model sandworm used in David Lynch's 1984 adaptation of Dune. The Sotheby's There Are Such Things exhibition will be open to the public in New York City from March 29 to April 3rd, with the online auction closing that same day. One truly diehard E.T. fan will then walk away with the movie prop, which Sotheby's estimates will sell for between $600,000 and $900,000. This next article is from the Environment, Animals, Wildlife Endangered Species section and is entitled Cougar Cubs Spotted in Michigan for the First Time in Over a Century. Written by Andrew Paul, published March 15, 2025. Quote, "It's something that should be celebrated, that we have the habitat to support an elusive animal like this," unquote. This article begins with a photo of a cougar kitten next to a car tire in the snow. Its caption reads, "Cougars were hunted to extinction in the area during the early 1900s. Cougar cubs have not been documented in Michigan in over 100 years, but state biologists can confirm recent photos officially ended the dry spell. On March 13, Michigan Department of Natural Resources released a trio of images that show a pair of tiny cougars roaming a snowy portion of the Upper Peninsula in Ontonagon County. Although the big cats are native to Michigan, humans hunted them out of existence by the early 1900s. While the Department of Natural Resources has verified 132 sightings of adult cougars since 2008, all of them were believed to be transient males from western states. In the meantime, the local population has failed to rebound, and they remain on Michigan's endangered mammals list. There is an additional photo of cougar kittens running on the snowy side of the road as seen from inside a vehicle. Its caption reads, "The two people who first spotted them initially believed them to be bobcats." On March 6, a pair of motorists driving in the western Upper Peninsula spotted what they at first believed were kittens from a different wildcat species. Quote, "He thought they were bobcat kittens, and so he took some pictures of them, and someone else actually stopped, and they both talked about them like, 'Oh, neat kittens,'" unquote. Brian Rowell, a wildlife biologist and Michigan's large carnivore specialist, recently told local news. But state biologists believed the tiny animals didn't match bobcat cubs after being tipped off to the pictures. Further consultation with out-of-state wildlife experts led them to confirm the kittens were actually 7 to 8 week old cougars. Given their young age, they also concluded their mother gave birth to them somewhere in the state. While the drivers didn't see her at the time, it's very possible that she was somewhere nearby, since cougars remain with their mother until they are around 2 years old. That said, it's also possible they were unfortunately already on their own. There was a third photo, a cougar kitten crouching in the snow. Its caption reads, "The kittens were estimated to be 7 to 8 weeks old." Quote, "Those young cougars are very vulnerable right now. We don't know where they are or if they're even alive. Mother Nature can be very cruel," unquote, Rowell explained in a separate statement to the Detroit News. Regardless, just spotting the cubs at all is good news, since it represents the first known modern cougar births in the western Great Lakes states. Quote, "It's something that should be celebrated, that we have the habitat to support an elusive animal like this," unquote, said Rowell. In any case, Michigan Department of Natural Resources representatives took the occasion to remind the public that, should they start seeing more cougars, to leave them alone. It's illegal to harass or hunt them, or even attempt to locate their dens. As such, Rowell and his fellow wildlife biologists aren't releasing more specific details on where the two cougar cubs were last seen. But with any luck, the photos may be the first of many to come as cougars return to the area. This next article is from the Science, Space, Solar System, Moons section and is entitled, "A Startup Wants to Mine the Moon for Helium." Written by Andrew Paul, published March 17, 2025. Helium-3 is needed for nuclear reactors, quantum computers, and more. This article begins with a photo. Its caption reads, "An Apollo 12 high oblique view of the lunar near side looking northeast toward the crater Copernicus, in center near horizon, as photographed from lunar orbit." A startup company wants to establish mining operations on the moon to extract a rare isotope needed for future quantum computers and nuclear fusion reactors. And according to one of its scientific advisors, there's little reason to, quote, "preserve the environment," unquote, in the process. Following the completion of Firefly Aerospace's Blue Ghost mission on March 16, the era of private lunar landers is officially underway. But Firefly is far from the only private company eager to reach the moon. Co-founded by a former Blue Origin employee and an Apollo 17 astronaut, Interlune aims to conduct its first lunar excursion in 2027, with plans for multiple additional trips if all goes according to plan. But Interlune's aims aren't purely scientific. They want to mine the moon's possible trove of helium-3 isotopes. Helium-3's utility comes from its single neutron, which allows it to cool to extremely low temperatures. This attribute makes it particularly useful in constructing certain types of quantum computers, and it also may serve as fuel in nuclear fusion reactors. But while helium-4 occurs abundantly on Earth, it's far more difficult to find naturally occurring examples of its single neutron relative. Helium-3 is so rare here that the ratio between the two isotopes is estimated to be roughly 1 to 1 million parts helium-4. According to Interlune, a single kilogram of helium-3 is estimated to be worth around $20 million. However, helium-3 isn't as rare elsewhere in the solar system. The Sun, essentially a gigantic nuclear fusion reactor, emits plumes of highly energized solar wind containing large amounts of the isotope. Earth's magnetic field deflects the majority of these winds, but given that the Moon lacks a similar field, helium-3 regularly bombards its surface. All that helium-3 eventually is trapped as bubbles inside rocks scattered throughout the top layers of lunar soil, also known as a regolith. If a company hypothetically harvested those isotopic gas pockets, they could facilitate a massive new resource hub for some of the most advanced and expensive projects back on Earth. Interlune aims to do just that. The Seattle-based company, formed in 2020, hopes to prove there are enough helium-3 reserves on the moon to warrant the first full-scale lunar mining operation. Interlune is financed by a number of private investors, and even received a $375,000 grant from the Department of Energy in 2024. On March 11, during the annual Lunar and Planetary Science Conference, LPSC, the company's chief scientist pitched the company's latest updates, Prospect Moon. Currently slated to launch no earlier than 2027, the Prospect Moon mission relies on contracting another company's lunar lander through NASA's Commercial Lunar Payload Services, CLPS, program. Mission planners will then pack a regolith sampling system, helium-3 mechanical processor, mass spectrometer, and a multispectral imager into the lander for delivery to a currently unspecified region of the moon. Once there, Interlune's equipment will gather data and analyze regolith samples, then beam the results back to Earth. But even if everything goes smoothly during the Prospect Moon mission, that doesn't mean companies will rush to start mining. For starters, experts still aren't sure how much helium-3 is contained in regolith. The only samples on Earth came during the Apollo missions, and they showed only small levels of the isotope. That said, it's possible some of the original reserves were unknowingly released during the bumpy ride home, meaning lunar helium-3 levels may still be high enough to warrant commercialization. Then there's the legality. Despite the multiple U.S. flags erected by Apollo astronauts, no country claims any actual jurisdiction over the moon. Any kind of large-scale and long-term project, especially something as potentially lucrative as helium-3 mining, will undoubtedly set off an international debate about lunar territory. And like nearly every terrestrial mining operation on Earth, extracting resources from the moon could result in massive ramifications for the moonscape. Speaking with New Scientist, however, at least one Interlune affiliate doesn't think it's worth much thought. Quote, "There's no life there, so why do we need to preserve the environment?" Unquote. Clive Neal, an unpaid scientific consultant for the company, said on Monday. At the same time, Neal conceded other mitigating factors that might influence Interlune's approach to lunar mining. Given the moon's importance across cultures around the world, dirtying Earth's only natural satellite before humans even permanently set up shop may be an issue. quote, how other cultures view the moon and changing the surface of the moon requires those cultures to be part of this conversation, unquote, he added. Regardless of any other factors that might arise, large-scale lunar mining projects are likely years down the road. That offers plenty of time for Interlune, international regulators, governments, and environmental advocates to start on those conversations. Interlune did not respond to requests for clarification at the time of publication. Well, that brings us to the end of this week's material from Popular Science magazine. I'm Michael Piotrusz, and I'll be back soon with more interesting articles. Thank you for listening.